It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. When Russians first came to Alaska in the 1740s, they were seeking fur, and fur-bearing animals were an important element of the Alaska economy for more than 200 years. Today, Alaska still has thousands of trappers, both those who make a living at it and those who do it for fun. On our show, we'll have one of each and learn about this traditional but largely invisible part of the Alaska lifestyle and mystique. It's a challenging skill that takes time to learn but sounds fairly addictive. And later in the show, we'll dive into the history of trapping with Michael Carey, who studied old-time trappers and whose father was one when he was a child. And my guests today are both trappers. Jeff Tuttle is with the Alaska Frontier Trappers, and you're sort of a hobbyist trapper with your airplane, right, Jeff?
Yeah, it's a hobby for me now, but I've been doing it 28 years, grew up doing it.
And Richard Person, who it turns out I knew in high school and skied with at one time, that's another story, is with us, and he's the chair of the South Central Chapter of the Alaska Trappers Association. Thanks for being with us, Richard.
You bet.
So it sounds like this has been a lifelong thing for you in some sense, Richard. You got into it when you were young.
Yeah, just a little. I have commercial fished my whole life, so I'm definitely a harvester.
Mm-hmm. And what's, your dad took you out to do it, or how did you first, learn to do this?
Most of my learning came when I was in college. I had another student there who, we went out and trapped marten and otter in Sitka, and I learned a lot there. Came back and stood away from it for a few years, and then when my son got a little older, well, I had a son, and then he got older, he had an interest in it, and we began exploring it again.
Yeah, Richard and I are both very young, so you'd be amazed that we... I'm just joking. So you went to Sheldon Jackson?
Yes.
I mean, trapping is not like the typical college activity, you know, like beer bashes or whatever, but so that's pretty cool. That's kind of a cool Alaska thing.
It really was. It was a great place. It had, I got introduced to deer hunting there because there are no deer around here, of course, and it was a great time.
Yeah. So, Jeff, tell me about your story. How did you get into it?
Well, I grew up on a big horse ranch in Northern California, and everyone in my family, my grandpa especially, and I had an uncle that trapped a lot. The uncle in particular, that was the only job he ever had. He was a state trapper, and then later on he worked for the feds trapping. And so I started trapping. I caught my first fox when I was four. And then I was pretty much hooked from then on. And, as the 80s progressed on, we were also involved in the timber industry. And, so during the winter, when you weren't falling timber, there was a couple of years there where our winter income was fur sales. Interesting. You know, I tell people that and they're in California. So yeah, that's how I got into it. And I just trapped on our ranch, every year. And I remember when I was really little, my uncle, who worked for the feds, he used to have a coyote in a cage that he had caught when it was a pup. And he used to, it had a grate in there, and he saved all the feces and stuff that comes out of it to trap. So it was a pretty big deal.
As like bait?
Yeah, it would use it as lure. And
because other coyotes would be interested in that.
Yeah, there's a P-post set, they call it.
Wow.
Yeah. Well,
there's obviously a lot about this that I don't know, which is almost the whole thing. I mean, I guess what I know about trapping is the history part of it that, you know, that's sort of was the original basis of Alaska's economy going all the way back to, you know, 18th century. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in the last part of the show, but it's still around. It hasn't disappeared. And I guess up in the interior in the Arctic and Southwest Alaska, there's still people who make their living that way. But in our part of the state, it's mostly recreational, right, Jeff? I mean, it's something you go out to do so that you can get outdoors.
Mostly, yeah. It's mostly recreational for a majority of people. There's a few people here that we both know that make pretty good money during the winter with it. But it's really, for me, just a tradition. And if I couldn't go flying and trapping and cross-country skiing in the winter, I wouldn't really have a reason to live up here in the winter. You know,
yeah.
I don't know how people don't get out and do stuff. So that's what it is for
me.
Yeah,
that's what our show's all about.
Yeah.
So what brought you to Alaska? Was it the military service or?
Yeah, interesting enough, I joined the Coast Guard when I just turned 17 to get away from ranching, and I got stationed 30 miles from my hometown. Uh-huh. And so for 3 years, I was active duty, and on my off days, I still had to go home and do chores. And then I saw a solicitation for Kodiak. It came open to be an MP in military police, and I said, heck yeah, I'll go do that, you know. And I transferred up there to Kodiak just to do one tour. And within the first week of being on Kodiak, I thought, this is where I'm going to stay. And that was in 2002. And just by sheer luck and knowing people, I guess, I've managed to stay up here since then. And I've actually been stationed in the Anchorage Bull since 2004.
I see. So tell me what you do when you're a trapper. I mean, you have an airplane, so like once a week you go out, or what? I don't know how often you even go out and how far you go, and just give me the rundown of what.
Yeah, generally, you know, if you're trapping, say, like lynx or marten, for instance. In my situation where you have a normal job that you've got to do, you'll go out every weekend and check your traps. And that's pretty much the norm. There's a few guys that, you know, like a friend of mine, Rick, who's retired, he would run numerous trap lines targeting different species, and he'd go out every 2 days and check different trap lines, and he would kind of stagger it. So for a majority of people, though, it's they check their traps once a week.
Mm-hmm. So how many traps do you have? I mean, and would you like go on the weekend or something?
Yeah, we'd go out and every weekend you attempt to put more out. And what you're looking for is, you know, you're looking for sign. After you've been doing it a while, you really start to learn and understand what the animals are doing. And
so there's a lot of skill involved. It's not just throw a trap.
Oh yeah, no, it's you know, talking about, you know, you're trapping, you know, wolves or coyotes in a trail set. You know, most dogs or canines are right pawed. And so, you know, you want to put it on the right side of the trail. Or if there's a slight incline in the trail, you want to put it in a certain spot on the incline. Mm-hmm. You will trap your entire life and never learn at all. I mean, it's almost being comparable to a biologist. In fact, we share a lot of information with Fish and Game.
So how big of an area? And do you have like a designated area you go to that's just for you, or is it just like what?
No, it's you just kind of want to stay off of other people's toes. You know, you don't want to, mm-hmm. Of course, in every hobby or industry, there's people that, you know, don't really care. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for me, if I go look somewhere new, and I see that there's someone else that has a trap line there, or even if I think there could be a trap line there, I won't trap there just out of respect. But, you know, there are people that will come and set a trap, you know, right next to yours. Mm-hmm. And you just have to deal with it, you know. Yeah. But it's part of doing business.
So if you go out once a week, how often have you caught something? Like every time you go out?
Depending on what you're targeting, I really like trapping lynx. That's one of my favorite things. I just think they're awesome animals, and they're on a 10-year cycle, and they usually lag 1 year behind the rabbits. So right. When there's a lot of rabbits, you're going to have a lot of lynx. So right now we're recovering from a crash with the rabbit population, and, you know, and that correlates with, you know, low lynx numbers. So right now, you know, if I had 100 traps out, generally when Rick and I were trapping lynx during the peak season, we would have easily 100 traps out just for lynx. We would catch one or two every weekend. Hmm. So, and it would generally, you know, 30, for a lynx line, it'd be on a snow machine, 30 to 50 miles. With the airplane, now it's, you know, I can do hundreds of miles.
So do you land at each trap, or how does that work?
Yeah, depending on how I have it set up, like with marten traps, or even wolverine sets, lynx sets, and especially like if you want to target wolves, you can, especially with wolves, because they're so smart, you don't want to disturb the area. You know, set your trap and forget it. And just, you know, with me, I fly over the area and just, you know, look at it. With marten sets, if you set them in the right location, you can fly over them real slow and see if anything's in the trap, see if anything's disturbed. But generally, if you know you're trapped in a really wooded area, yeah, you've got to land and, you know, snowshoe over or ski over to your sets. Or one thing that I like doing is I'll land, say, on a lake, and I'll take a little tow-behind sled, my cross-country skis with me, and I'll make a big loop on my skis and then come, you know, set traps wherever I find sign and then come back to the plane and go to another lake, you know, mm-hmm. just keep doing that. And
so what is one of the, and so you're, I'm just still working my way through the step-by-step process here. So you caught an animal like a lynx.
Yeah.
And then you would take that, bring that back to Anchorage, and would you go through the whole process of preparing it into a fur and then selling it, or what would you do with it?
There's two things that you could do. You could keep it for yourself, or you could sell it on the fur market. And if you're going to keep it for yourself, yeah, you'd take the animal, you'd bring it back, and you'd skin it. You'd skin it out, and if you're selling it on the fur market, there's a specific way that you have to skin each animal, and then there's specific ways you have to stretch the hide for presentation, and you get graded on your presentation and how well you take care of the fur, and it kind of goes...
A lot more skill involved there. Yeah.
Oh, a lot. Yeah, that's another thing that, you know, every year you'll learn new things, talk to different people, mm-hmm. and learn new skills, new ideas of doing things. And then the NAFA, the fur auction people out of Canada, they send people here every year, and we have seminars, and they tell us, hey, don't do this, do this. But anyway, so yeah, you'll skin it, put it on a stretcher, dry the hide. And certain animals, you have to get sealed by the state. You have to check it in with Fish and Game. And then mail it in to NAFA or whatever auction house you decide to use to be put up for auction.
Oh, wow.
Or you can take it and just send it out to a fur tannery and get it tanned and keep it for yourself. Or you can sell it, mm-hmm. A tanned hide.
So how much do you get for, like, from auction for a lynx, for example?
It fluctuates. I haven't sold any lynx in a while.
An otter trapper.
Oh, that's right. You're an otter, yeah. It really fluctuates lately. I think...
Or just ballpark.
Man, yeah. I would figure right now for lynx, you know, you'd be safe to assume $80 to $100, mm-hmm. which isn't.
You're probably not paying for your gas in your airplane in that case.
No, yeah, definitely. I mean, I bought this plane 3 years ago, and I've got $110,000 into just the plane.
Uh-huh.
So I mean,
you're gonna have to catch a lot of
$80. You're an effort, yeah. It's totally.
And what kind of plane is it?
It's a Super Cub.
Okay,
so.
So Richard, you got a sort of a different profile. Like you go out boating in the Sound, and tell us like what a typical outing is for you.
Well, the scary part is usually going through traffic and getting there on the winter roads.
Oh, you're boating in the Sound in the winter.
Yeah.
What size boat?
26-foot cabin cruiser.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it's we run about a 200-mile loop, and. You know, weather is a huge deal,
mm-hmm.
and we have to...
You sleep on board.
We sleep on board, usually. We do have a camp we set up some years, and that is helpful to get out of the boat, but it also requires you to go back to camp every night, which takes more fuel and time. And as you know, we get 6 hours of daylight during the winter, and so you find yourself navigating in the dark and in the snow a fair amount.
My experience is that boating in the wintertime is like the coldest activity that you could ever do. I mean, I've done a lot of stuff, but I mean, boating when it's kind of damp and you're kind of sedentary, it's really cold.
We have a heater in the cab. Otherwise, it wouldn't happen at all.
There you go. So how much like you have certain islands you're going to, or how does this work?
We follow along the coast. Mm-hmm. Certainly, we'll set islands. We generally will... do a little research with Google Earth or maps to find areas that we anticipate we'll find our animals we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And then we go and look firsthand. There's a lot of getting off the boat to check things out.
Yeah, and a lot of deep snow out there. What do you use, snowshoes or?
We have learned not to make sets where you have to get snowshoes on.
All right.
Yeah, so we look for places where the forest comes down close to the high tide line, and once you get under the trees, the snow is a lot more manageable.
Mm-hmm.
You avoid large openings.
So you mentioned otter, land otter, obviously, not sea otter. So is that your primary target, or are there other animals too?
It is. We also try for marten and wolverine. Martin are kind of on a down cycle right now, pretty much everywhere, it seems like. So this year we focused pretty much on otter.
Mm-hmm. And so, and I asked the same question about the lynx. How much is an otter worth?
You know, the fur market is a commodity. And as much as it seems hard to believe that the winters in Russia and China, the colder they are, the better the otter sell. And it's that way for a lot of fur. And so you would think that we were in a global community where prices would not be affected by something as simple as a cold winter.
Uh-huh.
So right now, the fur
market... Because that's where people are buying the otter to make coats?
Yeah, yeah. And that's another thing that surprises me, because I'm thinking, how can these people all afford fur coats?
But right.
Apparently that's, you know, maybe it's just the middle class and upper that are buying these coats, but the weather plays a big factor in the market.
Uh-huh. So in talking with Jeff, it sounds like it really is recreation, because his break-even point is like way over the horizon. What for you, is it more of an economic thing, or is it still?
Oh, it helps. Definitely helps. Mm-hmm. I don't have that much money into my boat.
I didn't get an actual figure for how much an otter is worth. So you can't let you get away with
actually,
that.
We are hoping to average $80-$85 mm-hmm. a pelt this year.
Okay.
Last year we averaged $94 at the auction houses, and better here in the local fur around the auction. And I sell to sowers that are local too.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, Fern Rondi's coming up. We're pre-recording, but the show will be on the air February 5th. So Ferrandi's a few weeks in the future. So that auction is for real. That's like Alaska trappers who are selling their own stuff.
Yep, that's exactly right.
And is that one of the better places to sell first?
It really is. We probably get better prices at that auction than most auctions in the world, but we can only handle so much fur is the thing. It just, we have two Saturdays, and as fast as we go, you know, as soon as the sun goes behind the Hilton Hotel, people want to go home. So
yeah, yeah. So and it seems like boating in the Sound in the wintertime, starting out like from Anchorage or from Chugiak or wherever you're starting out from, and then with maybe 6 to 8 hours of daylight, this is a you got to get up, get out there, spend the whole day doing your thing, and then. Well, and how many days would be out there? The whole weekend or the whole week? Or
I am not governed by weekends. I'm
fortunate. You're a fisherman,
I'm
right.
Self-employed, so we just try and go every 5 or 6 days, and then we'll spend up to 7 days. But when we're starting the line, and it takes a lot longer to put out all the traps. Uh-huh. But an actual check or average check is more like a three or four day run.
So every like 8 days or so, 3 days are out there. Yeah. Wow.
Something like that.
Pretty much just close to a half-time job or more than, yeah.
It definitely occupies your life. And if you've trapped the whole 5 month season, you don't get a whole lot else done.
Uh-huh. So, but I mean, you must enjoy being out there. I bet it's really beautiful.
There are some really great times.
Yeah. And then there's some horrible, horrible weather where you just have to hole up.
Yeah, there's some scary times too.
Uh-huh, sure. So who's going with you?
I started doing it with my oldest son, Joseph, the same youngster who got me back into this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also go out with another fellow, Kevin Kidder, retired Air Force guy who is able to, you know, have time to do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally other guys will go out with me.
Mm. Do you need some kind of permit or designated area, or is it like Jeff was saying, just like anywhere you want to go on the Sound?
There's some private property on the Sound.
Right.
You know, you need to be respectful of that. But for the most part, it's a national forest, and it's open for trapping.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I'm learning a lot today. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking about trapping, and that was Richard Person talking, who is the chair of the South Central Chapter of the Alaska Trappers Association. And we also have Jeff Tuttle, who is a past vice president of the Alaska Frontier Trappers. So you put out the trap. Is it a different kind of trap for each kind of animal?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I mean, there's so much to learn about this, isn't there? I mean, it's not something you just go into without a good deal of instruction.
Oh, yeah.
And we want to get into that. But I mean, does the trap kill the animal, or do you kill the animal after you find it, or how does that work? Or is it different for each type?
It's different for each type. There's traps that are designed to kill the animals. Those are called conibears.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get into snares. You run snares, and those are designed to kill. And then you have your foothold traps, which is traditionally what everyone pictures when they think mm-hmm. of trapping, and that is just designed like a foothold to grab onto their foot and hold them there. Generally, it really depends on the weather we're having. So then with your smaller animals, like your marten, if they get caught, their metabolism's so high that they'll expire pretty quick in cold temperatures. Your larger animals won't. They'll stay alive for a few days. But you know, if you're checking your traps every 5-6 days, you're finding your bigger animals are alive in the footholds. So.
Uh-huh. And then do you dispatch them with a gun, or how do you? Because you're trying to save the fur from damage, right?
With a wolverine, absolutely would have to dispatch it with a 22 or something.
Mm-hmm.
With lynx, because their fur stains so easily, we actually found when you catch them in a foothold and they're still alive, we've been using a snare. And they expire pretty quick within a few seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that doesn't sound like exactly the fun part of what you're doing.
No, I mean, it's never, you know, anybody that, you know, looks forward to the killing aspect of it, you know, then that's obviously something's wrong with you.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's always sad. I grew up hunting and trapping and, you know, I guide to a little bit and, you know, and. Yeah, you know, every time you do take something's life, you know, you always have deep respect and some, you know, little bit of regret in there, you know, because you're killing something. But, you know, if you're respectful and, you mm-hmm. know, you take care, you know, you kill it and, you know, you use the animal and it has a reason for it, then, you know, that's how I justify it.
Yeah.
You know?
So, I mean, in Alaska, I think it would be pretty unusual to find anybody like protested against hunting. I mean, that's really a super widespread part of our Alaska lifestyle. Trapping, obviously, is sort of how Alaska got started, but now it's kind of a small niche thing. But still, we have a fur auction at our big winter carnival and stuff.
Yeah.
Do you run into sort of opposition to trapping, or people say what you're doing, you know, shouldn't be allowed or anything? And how does that... I would think it would be from California. It would be way you'd be running a lot of that. But do you run into that in Alaska?
Yeah, you do. It's not as much as, you know, I did when I was growing up. But up here, yeah, you still have definitely the opposition to it. And kind of what I love talking to people about anything, and especially things that I like. And if people are willing to talk about things, then I'm more than willing to give them, you know, my views on it, and I'm not trying to change anybody's mind. Just, you know, I ask people to look at things from a different point of view, and I'm kind of against, like my wife and I, we both agree that anyone who's a complete extremist on either end, you know, you're not
going to have a conversation.
No, absolutely not. So that's kind of where.
How do you feel about that, Richard? Do you run into people who say, you know, you shouldn't be doing that, or is it more like it's Alaska, so people are cool with it?
I think that you occasionally run into people like that. It's not real common.
Mm-hmm.
We spend quite a bit of time trying to teach trappers to avoid conflict with other trail users and other outdoor people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an ongoing task.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, you hear people say, don't put traps in Chugach State Park because my dog will get caught. Is that something that you guys have to, I mean, do dogs get caught in these traps? I don't know.
Occasionally, yeah. We have incidents every year that, you know, someone's dog and will get caught in a snare or a trap. And that's really unfortunate. There's really no easy answer for it, mm-hmm. you know, because generally what a lot of other trappers will say is, well, you know, there's a leash law. And technically the dog owner's the one actually breaking the law. On the other end of it, though, when you do catch someone's dog in the trap, there's emotions run so high with people's animals that they tend to take a stance on that and, you know, go full-fledged after your hobby or activity. Mm-hmm. And it sure does. It's very easy for something like that to gather steam and, you know, have, unfortunately, a lot of people against you all of a sudden. And it really is. It's almost, I call it like the Disney effect. You know, emotions run so high when it comes to stuff like that that, you know, there's really, you can't argue with it, because it's, you can't argue with them, people's emotions. Mm-hmm. And so,
well, I guess people feel like, you know, they're in Alaska, they want to run, have their dog run loose while they're hiking, which may or may not be a good idea.
Right.
But we did have a show on taking your dog outdoors. And one thing we talked about was learning how to get your dog out of a trap. And there's a video on the Fishing Game website, mm-hmm. which we will link at alaskapublic.org if people want to check that out. It's probably a good idea if you're going to go and have your dog off leash to learn how to do that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole point of it, you know, that we promote is shared trail use. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't like the idea of people trying to limit our activities. And as on the exact flip side of that, I would never ask anybody to limit their activities, you know, ski joining or, you know, cross-country skiing. I'm for all that. Yeah. So.
But for the most part, it sounds like what you guys are doing, you're kind of out in the wilderness where that's not really going to be an issue.
Yeah.
Is there trapping that happens right here in town?
Yeah, you know, there are guys, and generally what you'll run into is, you know, guys just getting into it, mm-hmm. just starting, and it's almost like ignorance is bliss. You mm-hmm. know, they don't know that they're doing something. It may not be illegal to the letter of the law what they're doing.
But maybe it's just not that smart.
But yeah, you know, it's absolutely legal for me to go set a trap on, you know, somebody's trail that obviously I can see, say somebody's cross country skiing every weekend or mm-hmm. walking their dogs. Absolutely, completely legal for me to go set a trap. Would I do that? No, because I don't want to catch someone's dog.
It's just a really bad idea.
I'm not evil, right. You know? and you know, you got to think about that. You know, uh-huh. you got to think about your actions and the defense of well, your dog's not on a leash. You know, it only goes so far. Uh-huh. So
yeah. Outdoor Explorer, we're talking about trapping today with Jeff Tuttle and Richard Persons. Let's talk a little bit more about that educational piece. Richard, it sounded like you sort of got back into this teaching your son to do it. And do you guys at the Alaska Trappers Association, do you do sort of classes and stuff for people?
Yeah, we have a beginning trapping class here in South Central, third Saturday in October generally.
Uh-huh.
And the parent group in Fairbanks runs a annual beginning trapping class too up in Fairbanks. And, you know, just like at Frontiers meetings, monthly meetings, we do instruction during those little, you know, this is how you trap Martin or this is how you want to trap Wolverine. And we try to do the best we can to give beginners a heads up on how to avoid conflict with other people.
Right. So do you, what are the main things you need to learn before you can do this? I mean, obviously you need to learn like how the trap works, but it sounds like from talking to Jeff that there's a lot of sort of issues about the individual species that you won't be that successful maybe until you learn something about where to put the traps, right?
Where to put the traps is really important. Yeah, definitely. And each species is a little different. That's where, you know, when you go, if you're going to go trapping, you should do some research. You should talk to people, go to some of these meetings or schools and just prepare yourself the best you can. The first year we got back into it, we were going to go catch some wolves, by golly. And we spent a lot of time and effort up in the Knik River Valley. I think we caught some squirrels, but no wolves. And we ran into some trappers who said, hey, you should go check out this school. And we did. And what do you know, our catch started improving dramatically. So, uh-huh.
So you need to learn how to bait the trap, where to put the trap, different kinds of traps that are appropriate, seasons. I mean, a lot of information.
Yeah, well, you need to know your quarry. You need to know the life cycle and the habits of what you're trying to catch.
Uh-huh. How long did it take before you sort of ramped up to where you thought, wow, I'm going to spend 3 days a week or 5 days a week on this during my winters, and it's really going to, you know, to where you realize that this is actually something I really enjoy and it's going to be, you know, successful?
It was a gradual thing. You know, we went on a lot of drop-off deer hunts over the years on Prince William Sound, and did some trapping while we were out on some of those islands, and it just occurred to me one time on our way back, you know, I could do this a lot more because I have some boats, and we just began exploring the Sound and spending more time there.
Yeah. What's your favorite thing about being out there?
I just... really like being in God's creation. It's like a sanctuary for me, although there are times it tries to kill you, but it's just a really wonderful place to be, and especially if you can get out there with your family. And
yeah, I bet in the wintertime it's awesome because it would be so beautiful with the snow, and hardly anybody else or no one else is there, right?
We don't see too many people.
Yeah, nice. So is your son an adult now, or is it?
He's 28.
Okay. So is he carrying this on, like, sort of side by side with you as a business?
Pretty much, yeah.
And fishing as well?
Yeah, he still fishes.
So where do you guys fish?
We fish down on the Nanelchik Beach on the east side of Upper Cook Inlet.
Uh-huh. So you have a set net site?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, another controversial issue we can talk about. Although I don't know that one needs to be controversial, right?
I don't think so.
No, me neither. So... So, Jeff, do you guys do educational stuff as part of your organization?
Yeah, we've been doing a school the last few years, the first Saturday of October. I've been talking with the ATA for the last 2 years, and I think next year we're going to run one jointly. You know, there's no reason why we should be having two schools 2 weeks apart from each other when we can just combine forces and help even more people out. And you know, they have a wealth of experience that, you know, our people aren't having access to, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, really just the knowledge is power. You know, the more people that we have involved, and the more things we can learn from each other, just will help both of us. So,
is there some reason that there's two organizations, or is just that's the way it has happened to come about?
Yeah, back in the 80s, the ATA was the Interior Trappers Association, and there was lack of representation for this area of Alaska. And so then they started the Alaska Frontier Trappers Association in Palmer, and it's kind of just been hanging around for the last, you know, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And just in the last few years has gotten to be quite large. And then the ATA South Central Chapter has been around for quite some time, and they're a very large organization.
So how many people are doing this? I mean, do you have a sense of, like, an anchorage of how many people are actively involved in trapping on some level?
I actually looked on the ADF&G website before coming down here, and they said 8,000 trapping licenses are sold on the average.
For the state?
For the state.
Yeah.
That is a lot of people, really, for something that's almost invisible.
And that doesn't count the senior citizens who have a permanent license. There's still some of them out there.
Interesting. So if somebody wants to get into this, where do they get the traps? Do you have to go and buy them to try it the first time, or you can borrow them from somebody, or how does that work?
There's different, you know, the internet, you know, you can order anything you want on the internet. I mean, obviously we don't have skunks up here, and one of the main lures I use is skunk essence. And so it's amazing. You know, my wife loves it. So,
but hey, look what came in the mail, honey.
Hey, sweetheart, the mailman flipped me off today. so
the animals like that?
Yeah, it's a curiosity thing. Mm. You know, they just smell something new, and
probably goes a long way.
Oh, yeah. And it's very, very strong. But yeah, you know, and then there's.
You have to go and sort of buy your first few traps and to give it a try, basically.
Yeah.
Are they expensive?
They can be. You know, your little tiny traps, like your number ones that you'd use for muskrats, would probably cost brand new $6 or $7 a piece. But when you look at it, I have over 100 of those. And then I have thousands of snares, and I make my own snares. My Conibear traps, my big 330s that I use for catching beaver, I've got over 40 of those, and those are, you know, $25, $30 a piece. Mm-hmm. And then your wolf traps, like the Alaska number 9 is the famous wolf trap, and I think those are selling now with chain and swivels for right around $150 a piece. Mm-hmm. And so,
Sounds like it'd be good to go to one of these meetings and meet somebody and go out with them and find out if you actually enjoyed doing
it. Yeah, definitely. So, yeah.
Yeah. Is that something that happens? Like
a lot.
Take a newbie out and see what they think of it?
Absolutely. We encourage it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't, you're kind of just bumbling around in the dark.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when I moved up here, I had a lot of years experience trapping, and I wasn't getting anything. When I moved to Alaska and I went to the ATA's school, and I was like, oh, that's why, because everything's completely different in Alaska.
Well, I would think that skinning and preparing the hide, it would be, you really need to do that right. Otherwise, you're going to spoil the entire thing. How do you do that when you're working, Richard? Do you do it in the field or?
No. No, we bring the animal home, and a lot of times they're frozen, so they need to be thawed out, and you clean up the fur and then begin the fur handling.
Uh-huh. So what is required in terms of one of your land otters that you're catching? And you skin it, and then are you going to do some process for it to get it ready to go off to an auction house or something?
Yeah, you skin them, and then you need to remove all the fat and tissue from the hide. It's called fleshing, and it's a fairly involved process that takes a fair amount of energy and expertise. Some critters have less fat on them, and they're much easier.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a matter of putting them on the right size board and to the dimensions that your market has asked you to, and then they need to be in a warm, dry spot for a week or so to dry out.
So is tanning, that's a chemical process, right? That's taking it to the next level?
It really is, yeah.
And that's not something you do?
I tried it once.
Not fun?
Well, it's a timing thing, and there's these certain steps you need to put the hide through, and there's guys who do it and love it, and it's something they just like doing. I decided if I needed tan fur, I was going to send it off and have somebody else tan it. Mm-hmm. So.
And the flesh from these animals isn't really good for anything, right? Because it's not the kind of animal that we eat.
Oh, the meat?
Yeah.
Actually, I don't want to sound weird, but lynx meat is pretty good.
Really?
So, yeah.
I would never guess that.
Yeah, I know. But, yeah, when you get into the canines, no, they don't. But the tanning, I ran my own tanning business for a few years.
Oh, really?
And it's completely night and day. And anyone wanting to get into tanning, I would say send it off and have someone else do it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
well, it's really interesting. It sounds like it must be a labor of love, because I'm just trying to see how you'd make a lot of money at this, and I do not think that you
would. No, it's not.
But it sounds like a great way to get outdoors, and I really appreciate both of you being here. We're going to come back in a minute and talk about the history of trapping, how that figures into the development of Alaska, and why furs are such an important part of our history as a state, and before that as a territory. So I want to thank both of you for being here, Jeff Tuttle, the Alaska Frontier Trappers, and Richard Persons from the Alaska Trappers Association. Thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome.
We're going to take a quick break now. The story we're going to hear comes to us from Alaska historian Laurel Downing Bill. She's the charismatic personality behind the book series called Aunt Phil's Trunk. These are books that bring Alaska's little-known history treasures to life. In her second book, Laurel explores what trapping meant for Alaska natives as the gold rush waned. Here she is reading from a chapter called The Trapping Life.
Trapper's life back in the day was not an easy one. From early in the fall to the close of trapping season in April, many trappers traveled miles and miles of trap line with no company except their dogs. It was no job for a chichaco. Trappers could cover about 80 miles a week, checking to see if any animals had been caught in hidden traps. About 14 miles a day is my average travel on the circle, although I cover considerably more than that, of course, on the side trails, a trapper named Urich told Tom Jackson in an article for the October 1937 issue of the Alaska Sportsman. During the trapping season, there are only 6 hours of daylight at the most, and it's a long after dark before I reach the trail cabin at the end of a day's hike complete. Once trappers fixed something to eat and fed their dogs, then they had to skin and care for the furs they'd picked up along the line and prepare for the next day. Blinding storms are sometimes encountered far out on the trail between shelter cabins, and a biting wind with the thermometer at 40 below zero makes it seem twice that cold, Urich said. When a trap has been sprung, it has to be reset with bare hands, and it must be done quickly and carefully. Frozen hands can easily spell disaster to a trapper who is 100 miles from civilization. Although Urich trapped during the 1930s, his story is similar to those early trappers who turned to the last frontier to eke out livings in the wilderness. He started out helping colonists harvest their crops in the Matanuska Valley, but when he saw the prices paid for furs, he switched professions and turned to trapping. He chose a spot near Lake Lila on the divide between the Nelchina and Matanuska rivers. After unloading 6 months of supplies from a pontoon aircraft, he picked up an axe and began swamping a trail through a heavy growth of willows to build his headquarters cabin on higher ground. Once that cabin was finished, he spent a few years building another 6 cabins on the circumference of a circle whose center was the main cabin. He stored his winter supplies in a cache, about 18 feet above ground, to prevent wild animals from helping themselves to his food. Like Urich, most trappers didn't talk much about the money they made, nor the hardships they endured climbing creeks and mountain ridges as they routed out any unlucky fur bearers that happened to cross their paths. But they knew that any man who could make a living from trapping in Alaska could make a success of anything.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Charles Woolforth, Outdoor Explorer, and today we're talking about trapping in Alaska. During the first part of the show, we talked with 2 trappers, but we're going to take a different turn with the time we have left. Michael Carey, my old friend and colleague, is a journalist, joined us in the studio to talk about trapping history in Alaska. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the show, fur is sort of why Europeans originally came to Alaska, that we had fur hunters from Russia who showed up here in the 1740s, and for the first 200 years or so, fur was sort of like where it was at. But also in the 20th century, trapping and fur farming was really important.
Yeah, there are several important things here. First of all, going about the Russian period, it was commercial, to some degree it was industrial, and it was largely coastal. With the sea otter being the primary form of pelt.
Mm-hmm.
In the 19th century and late 19th century and 20th century, there was a great expansion as people moved away from the coastal areas and began, for obvious reasons, trapping different species of animals.
Right. And then the British were here sort of competing with the Russians in the interior with their trading posts and so forth. And is that kind of where the trapping economy got started, with trading posts?
Yes, it was important. The Canadian, the Hudson's Bay Company through Canada was here, and other companies eventually. They were more Canadian than British, but they came that way from the east to the west.
Mm-hmm. And where did your interest in trapping come from? I know you've been around, you spent your whole life in Alaska, and probably when you were a kid, you probably knew a lot of trappers.
No, I spent most of my life here, but I also have about 10 years in New York City where people wore fur. And there's a great story about my dad who was a trapper, and that's how I became interested in trapping and understood it, was in a fashionable elevator in Midtown Manhattan, and he was wearing a very handsome Martin hat. And a woman was wearing a similar hat, and she gave him a very dirty look. And he said, "Madam, there's a difference between our hats. You bought yours, I caught mine."
We could assume that she did, yeah. So his name was Fabian
Carey, yeah.
Fabian, you've written about him a million times. And, and so was he? Was that his full-time occupation?
There's a story here about the economy of Alaska and the economy of trapping. Trapping is, as anybody who's in the business would tell you, is as easily as erratic financially, if not more so, than the oil business. Right now, a couple of years ago, or even last year, Martin, the North American sable, were selling for around $100 a piece, according to Furfish Game magazine. I don't know what local buyers were giving for high-quality fur. Now they're about half that. And so much of the fur market these days in the modern 21st century is determined by what goes on in Russia and China. And especially these are bad times for people buying fur coats in Russia for reasons you're well aware of, and so are your listeners.
Right. So our earlier guest did mention this Russia-China market. Is that because people still wear fur there, whereas they don't wear fur much in Europe and the United States?
There's just more demand. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Russians themselves produce fur. There's fur farming all over parts of North America, but not all over North America. But that is a large part of the demand. Fur in this country goes in and out for their sort of, what should we say, political reasons why people mm-hmm. won't wear it. But on the other hand, if you go to New York or Chicago, you will quite clearly see people who aren't worrying about that consideration.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and this has always been true, right? Because there was a huge fur farming rush at the beginning of the 20th century,
right,
and then a tremendous collapse. Virtually every island along the coast of South Central Alaska was covered with foxes at one time, and you can still find the remains of fox farms here and there. And that's just because of
mostly what you find is what's left of the fence.
They can, or there's a few places where you can find some equipment and stuff if you really know where to look. Interestingly, we don't really focus on that history as much as we do our gold rush history. Every little gold mine and sluice is protected, but I don't know anything about
they have
fur.
Better mythologists,
yeah,
I
that's
guess.
That's right. Well, you better get to work. So Fabian was a trapper, and
he
what
came
was that
here,
like?
He came here from Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1937 and hooked mm-hmm. up with a fellow named Carl Hult, who became his partner and mentor, and trapped into the war when eventually he was drafted and served in the military. After the war, we trapped at the family did at Lake Minchumina, which is halfway roughly between Fairbanks and McGrath. And those were sort of golden years, the late 40s and into the early 50s, because there was this huge pent-up demand for luxury goods like fur as a result of World War II.
Hmm.
And a trapper could make a good living. And you could make a good living if you were careful, that would extend all the year round.
Hmm.
I think I should also mention that the trapping industry is not one solid monolith. There's always been a sort of tension between fur buyers and the trappers themselves. There's an old Ontario saying that has it: anything you can do to get the better of a fur buyer is moral.
That's true.
That's the trapper's point of view.
In your family, that was probably
accepted. And then there were always occasionally, there was the legendary fur buyers like Johnny Schwegler, who would come up here from Seattle. They were well respected, but every once in a while there'd be somebody showed up here who promised higher prices and proved to be something of a fraud. They'd send them your your fur, and they would not respond to your mail.
Mm. So Lake Minchumina is a really beautiful place west of of Mount McKinley, and I've been out there, and I guess there was a real community out there in those days, right?
Yeah, and it was an interesting community because you had such a variety of people. You had several Native families who originally had been the settlers there. You had people like my dad who settled there to trap, and then you had people who were, the FAA had a station there, a long field halfway between Fairbanks and McGrath, as I mentioned before, where you could get a DC-3, a DC-4, even now a DC-6 into there, and an FAA station where people were government employees, but they also occasionally took up trapping or other outdoor activities.
Hmm. You know, I was reading for a project I was working on, not just for recreation, the minutes of the Constitutional Convention. In that great Muktuk Marston moment when he comes forward and says, we've got to reserve lands for Alaska Natives, the main reason that he brings up, or one of his main reasons, is Native trappers have their trap lines, and then some newcomer, some Johnny-come-lately, will show up and start trapping right on top of the Native trap lines, which I guess nobody would have done in the good old days.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you know, we've got to make sure the Natives control their own land. He was unsuccessful, and of course, the rest is history. But it's interesting to me that the status of land in those days was just that you had your trap line, everybody knew it was your trap line, and they stayed off of it, right?
Right, or they were expected to, and it's an unusual kind of ownership that sort of accrues by use, and these were sold, although my dad bought pieces of Carl Hult's trap line near Minchumina, although your ownership, how would you prove it in court except by the court of tradition?
Mm. So you would actually pay somebody money for something that they obviously did not really own in any legal sense.
Well, I guess you could say since they cut the trails, which would be the most part of it, and there would be cabins in some cases, and all that was in the cabins, there might be stretching boards for fur. There might also be axes and a variety of other tools that you could buy. But as far as owning the wilderness, no.
Yeah, it was just the public domain.
As my dad would say. That was one of his favorite terms, yes.
So
he would also say that if you want free enterprise, try trapping. You're competing with Russians, Poles, Germans, Finns, the whole world.
And you're competing with predators and the weather and everything
else. And 50
else.
Below.
Right. Well, did they have fur auctions? I mean, we have the Fur Rondi, which people tend to think, oh, it's an old-time fur auction, but actually it was started by the Chamber of Commerce or something, and they added the fur auction.
When I was young, I think there were local buyers, but most of the fur was sent to Seattle, St. Louis, which most people don't know has a great history in the fur industry, going back all the way to the Mountain Men, and there were Moss and Steffens in St. Louis. There were also fur houses in New York. The old outdoor magazines were all full of advertisements for fur houses, and that was one of my dad's. He wrote a chapter on the fur houses. He called it "Our Price List Is Free."
Hmm. Yeah,
I think the implication was that's the only thing that's free.
Right, I get you. So there was this. Probably there were other communities like Minchumina all over Alaska.
Yes, that's true.
That were based on trapping.
Yeah, or that it contributed an important part to the economy. But thinking back to those days, you had dogs. One of the things you'll see in trapping photographs is small dog teams, and the reason is you had to feed all those dogs. And if you were out in the woods away from your home cabin, you had to bring all the food, which typically would have been dried fish of some kind. We, for the most part, used whitefish caught at Lake Minchumina, although there would also be cornmeal that would be added to it. And some people occasionally could, if you could find salmon at the right price and get it brought in, you would do that. Mm.
So you kind of grew up driving a dog team.
Well, I can't, if I was just unashamed and willing to tell complete fairy tales, I would talk about that. But I was very young, and mostly what I had the opportunity was to absorb this way of life and this kind of culture. And my dad discouraged me from continuing it because he just thought economically it was too dismal. And this affected him, where he worked in town different years. And also the animals are unpredictable. Mm-hmm. We trapped marten, although occasionally beaver. And they're just years where they're either not there or there's something has The numbers are down, and you can be just as talented and skilled and determined as you were the year before, and you don't make any money.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about sort of the decline and disappearance of this industry. I mean, now it's very much a tiny, tiny niche.
There are the people who pursue it are avid and determined and courageous in their own way, and some of them are weekend trappers. Some of them trap many days. They get involved in essentially a season. But I think part of it, channeling my dad, would mm-hmm. be Alaskans found out there are a lot easier ways to make a living. And you can spend 3 weeks on the trap line and take a projection of what you're going to earn, and 3 weeks on the North Slope. You're away from home the same amount of time, but the check is different.
Yeah, much different. So when did that decline and disappearance of that way of life take place?
I think the biggest changes were in the early to mid-50s, and maybe some of my friends and colleagues would disagree with me, into the late 50s when, after this big rush of interest in fur post-1945, post the end of World War II, prices declined, and then it became very hard to make a living. This coincided with a lot of older people either aging out of the profession or quitting.
Mm-hmm. Really the same time that the little gold miners were disappearing,
yeah,
too, and that whole Alaska was sort of becoming modern then in the late 50s, early 60s, yeah, with oil sort of starting to show up, statehood comes, and everything else.
And there were all kinds of people who undertook trapping. My dad collected many stories about them. It led him to conclude there were two groups, trappers and misfits with trapping license.
And now a lot of those places are depopulated. There's nobody out there.
Yeah, that's true. And this has been going on for a while. The original depopulation of the woods as we knew it in Alaska circa 1920 to 40 was a result of the airplane. Mm-hmm. There used to be roadhouses every so many miles if you went from Fairbanks to McGrath. Now there wouldn't be anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
In the 40s, my dad found a message that a trapper had written on cardboard, or rather a mail carrier had written on cardboard in an abandoned roadhouse. It said, "My last trip, airplane got me."
Oh, wow.
The airplane put the mail carrier who traveled by land out of business. There was no need for him.
Wow. So kind of sad, but you're sort of resurrecting this history in your occasional
writings. I'm resurrecting it in my head. That's the only way you can do it.
Ever plan to write a book about something?
Well, I have pages and pages of it, and we'll see what happens.
Oh, it'd be a great book. I would love to read it.
Thank you. That's a very kind thing to say.
No, I've always enjoyed those. I used to do those columns in the newspaper with them, too. Well, it's been a really interesting show. I want to thank my guest, Mike Carey, who you now know is a great expert on trapping and sort of lived that lifestyle with his family, Lake Minchumina, and has written a lot of interesting stuff based on old letters and court documents,
yes,
and newspapers and that sort
of
thing.
My dad's diaries.
Oh, right. What a gift. And earlier in the show, we heard from Richard Persons, who is a modern-day professional trapper and set netter, and Jeff Tuttle, who's traps just for the recreation of it, and really appreciated having them both on. Next week, we'll be talking about the Iron Dog Snow Machine Race. It's a 2,000-mile epic that crosses Alaska twice. It's one of those amazing things that happens only here, and I'll be talking to a pair of veteran racers and an organizer of the race, which will be starting downtown Anchorage this year for the first time. So join us for that. And our producer is Monica Gokey. We had help this week from Jeff Tuttle, Richard Person, Mike Carey, and Evan Erickson. Monica Gokey is our producer. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.